You sit down. Let me add my welcome to you here this morning at Grace Church Greenwich, and thanks to those of you joining us online as well. We're continuing our series in the 12th chapter of John's Gospel. This is the second of three, and I'm going to continue our reading from John chapter 12 and verse 36. You might help. It might help you to join with me. It's on page 899 for you if you'd like to make use of that too. John chapter 12 and from verse 36, or the second half of verse 36. When Jesus had said these things, he departed and hid himself from them. Though he had done so many signs before them, they still did not believe in him, so that the word spoken by the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. Lord, who has believed what he heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Therefore, they could not believe. For again, Isaiah said, he has blinded their eyes and hardened their heart, lest they see with their eyes and understand with their heart and turn, and I would heal them. Isaiah said these things because he saw his glory and spoke of him. Nevertheless, many even of the authorities believed in him, but for fear of the Pharisees, they did not confess it, so that they would not be put out of the synagogue. For they loved the glory that comes from man more than the glory that comes from God. And the question we're thinking about this morning is, what stops the world from believing? When you think about it for a second, it might seem a strange thing that God would make a world for most of it to reject him anyway. And the famous atheist comedian Ricky Gervais, he famously says, if there was a God, why would he make me an atheist? And you might think he has a good point. I've been reading this book by Carl Truman. It's a great book, actually, in many ways, and in which he explains how we've come from a world that believes in gods. He traces the story of kind of Western civilization, where we've moved from this worldview where God exists to one where God is kind of pushed to the sides and we don't believe in him anymore. Very useful in lots of ways. And you don't have to look very far at all, really, to find explanations that seem quite reasonable. Psychological reasons, sociological, economic reasons, political reasons, moral, intellectual, historical reasons, why it is that the world has stopped believing in God. Well, it turns out that the verses we've just read, John has his own answers to the question. We sometimes think, don't we, that we're the skeptical age. We've discovered the tools of reason and science, and we have insights that they didn't back then. Back then, people just kind of believed anything they were told. Well, that's not actually true. Unbelief and skepticism, they're not unfamiliar to John's gospel. I'm sure you noticed in our passage, as we had it read, look again at verse 37. Even though he had done so many signs before them, they still did not believe. So it's one thing to ask, why don't we believe now in the 21st century? But here's an even harder question for you. Why didn't they believe? The people that actually knew Jesus, people that saw him, people that interacted with him day to day and still rejected him. The whole way through this chapter of John, and last week as well, we've been tracing the story as Jesus approaches his death. We've had the drama, the tears, the crowds cheering, a pretty terrifying display of power from Jesus. We've had Jesus' own words about his death and what it means. But now, John, he kind of presses pause on the story. He wants to give us his own commentary, really, on what's been happening. And it's like John is kind of saying, look, guys, listen, I want you to stop for a second, and I want to tell you something about what you've been seeing. And his commentary of the first half of the book of John, in some ways, is this. Even though, verse 37, he had done so many signs before them, they still did not believe. Just imagine for a second if you had seen the things that they had seen. A dead man in a tomb, leaving his own tomb, having a few people around for dinner the next day. a blind man, as Andrew was describing to us earlier, blind from birth, describing the things he could see in front of him. Thousands upon thousands in the deserts, fed, gallons upon gallons of water turned to wine, and death defeated, hunger removed, illness stopped in its tracks. And would that be enough? If you had seen those things with your eyes, would that be enough to convince you that Jesus was worth taking seriously? You know, if you'd seen, literally seen those things happen. Well, it wasn't enough to convince them. Even though he had done so many signs before them, they still did not believe. And unbelief and skepticism, but then they're not a product of the Enlightenment. It's not that we got like progressively cleverer and cleverer and finally realized that we don't need God anymore. Unbelief, it's always been around. And at this point, it really looks like Jesus' message has failed, doesn't it? Right? And we know that some of us know that John kind of gives us something close to a purpose statement at the end of his book. He sort of tells you why he's written it. But just imagine if it was written like this. Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, but these are written so that you would not believe in him and so that you would reject Jesus. These are written so that you would see how much of a failure Jesus' ministry really was. Even though he had done so many signs before them, they still did not believe in him. We've known right from the beginning of John that Jesus came to his own and his own people did not receive him. But it's not really until now that we get the answer to why that is. What stops the world from believing? Unbelief, it needs an explanation, this kind of unbelief. And it turns out that there is one. Unbelief is not a surprise to Jesus. It's not a surprise to John. And it shouldn't be a surprise to us either. First point on your handouts. Don't be thrown. Unbelief is not a surprise to God. Let me read again from verse 37. Though he had done so many signs before them, they still did not believe in him, so that the words spoken by the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. Lord, who has believed what he heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? It turns out that long before Jesus even walked the earth, the prophet Isaiah had given Israel a message. This outstretched arm of God who would come to save them would himself be rejected. And I've put there on your handouts, unbelief, it's not a surprise to God. Firstly, because it was described in advance. Isaiah, hundreds of years before Jesus was around, he tells us plainly that the servant, God's servant, would be rejected. And he does it in this sort of poetic way with these rhetorical questions. You know, who has believed what he has heard from us? And I guess the expected answer is, well, basically no one at all. To whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? To which the answer is, well, not really anyone. It turns out this rejection, it was described way in advance that the saving work of the Lord Jesus Christ would be rejected from the get-go. They didn't believe so that, verse 38, the words spoken by the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. John's not embarrassed to say that people thought Christianity was stupid. Even within the pages of his own gospel and the unbelief of the people, it wasn't a failure of Jesus' message. It was exactly what was expected of them. Because sometimes it doesn't even matter how much evidence you give somebody, you know, however persuasive your arguments are, however much historical evidence you provide somebody with. Maybe you've experienced that. This time last year, I was trying to explain to some of you over Zoom. We were looking in our summer fellowship series about other figures from church history. I was desperately trying to explain the ontological argument for God's existence to some of you. And I won't even try and attempt to do it now. It's far more complicated for me. But the point is, however impressive your arguments for God are, for the Christian faith, and sometimes no amount of evidence is going to convince somebody. And it's not a surprise to God when people don't believe. And don't be thrown. Just because some impressive people think your faith is ridiculous. Or it looks like, you know, no one's turning up to the events that we put on. Or your friend just ignores that invitation for the 10th time. And don't be thrown just because institutions that control our media and power structures think that Jesus is irrelevant, and especially don't be thrown just because the religious institution of the day has largely pushed Jesus to the sides and began to preach a different message. God's not surprised. God is not shaken by that. And neither should we be. But actually, it's a little bit more serious than that. It's not just that the unbelief of the crowds here was kind of described in advance, but in fact, for these people, and I must stress that, for the people here in this particular story, Jesus goes even further. Unbelief, it was described in advance, but also in this case, secondly, it was planned in advance. Verse 39, therefore, they could not believe. For again, Isaiah said, he has blinded their eyes and hardened their heart, lest they see with their eyes and understand with their heart and turn, and I would heal them. Turns out that their rejection of Jesus, it wasn't just unsurprising or predicted, but it was planned. And I guess that will shock us slightly, right? And you know, what exactly is going on there? And God is preventing people from believing, it seems. God is blinding people. John, he takes us actually right back to the beginning of Isaiah here. An amazing chapter in Isaiah, the introduction really. Isaiah, he sees God's kind of throne room, and Isaiah himself is commissioned to preach a message to the nation. But it is a message that will ultimately leave Israel blind until they can't even see what's in front of them. And you know, you're thinking, right, what is going on here, right? It's one thing for God to kind of be aware of people's unbelief, right? To know about it in advance. I might know about a chess move that someone's going to make against me or something and predict it in advance. I know David Britton's fine, he predicts people's chess moves all the time. But it is another thing for God to actually be preventing them from believing. That sounds very strange. And why exactly would God do that? And the clue, actually, is in our first Isaiah quote. And the first quote, back in verse 38, is from Isaiah chapter 53, the verse that Laura read for us earlier, a description of the servant that God would send to his people. It's a very famous chapter. And in that description, Isaiah tells us that it is by being rejected that the servant can save his people. Let me say that again. It is by Jesus being rejected that he can accomplish this saving work. And listen again to Isaiah's words. Lord, who has believed what he heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? And then just a few verses later. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed him stricken and smitten by God and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. And the unbelief of the people, it was necessary for Jesus to go to the cross and to take on the sins of the world that we might be saved. Unbelief, it was necessary. It was planned. Well, let me put it like this. Imagine a different scenario. Imagine Jesus, he comes to the world and everyone sees him and says, oh, brilliant. Okay, here he is. He's the Son of God. Great, guys. And welcome. We've been waiting for you for so long. Terrific. We're here. Let's go. You know, what do you want us to do for you? And maybe like Herod shows up and says, oh, Jesus, fantastic. You're here. It's been so long. Finally, you know, it's great to meet you. The Romans kind of fall down at their feet. Judas doesn't betray him. Everyone loves him. Huge success. Except, well, now what? No rejection. No trial. We have no cross. We have no death, and we have no victory. And the cross, well, it had to happen. The rejection of the God of Israel as he walked the earth, it was absolutely necessary. The unbelief of the people, it was required to save the world. In other words, it's not just kind of blindness for the sake of blindness, but it is blindness at the cross that gives way to sight. As eyes are opened and we see the glory of God on display. It is darkness at the cross that gives way to light on the other side. It is death that gives way to resurrection. You see, the cross is the turning point. It is the center of history. Unbelief, it was described way in advance. And in their particular case, it was planned in advance. And so don't be thrown. Don't allow their unbelief to force you to doubt Jesus' credibility here. And the very thing that looks like it is failing is bringing about God's very plan of action. And this passage, it's reassuring us not to be kind of thrown by Jesus' projection. But finally, it's also a warning to us. And the warning is this, belief is not always a good thing. And you might think that's quite a strange thing to say. But third point on your handout, belief, it is not always a good thing. And this is true actually all the way through John's gospel. And so you might think of chapter 2 where Jesus, he doesn't entrust himself to people that believe in him, or actually the exact words are, you know, he doesn't believe their belief. Or you might think of chapter 6 and where it looks like an entire crowd of people are following him, ready to crown him. And then by the end of the chapter, they all leave. Or you might think of chapter 8, where we're told many people believe in Jesus. And then by the end of the chapter, the very same people are picking up stones to stone him. Belief's not always a good thing in John. And we're told explicitly what kind of belief we're dealing with here in verse 42. So here we go. 42, nevertheless, many, even of the authorities, believed in him. Okay, great, right? You know, most people reject him, okay? But there were a few. But, verse 42 again, for fear of the Pharisees, they did not confess it, so that they would not be put out of the synagogue. For they loved the glory that comes from man more than the glory that comes from God. You see, it turns out that they prefer the glory of this world to the glory of the cross. They prefer the life that this world offers. They prefer to stay in the dark where it is more comfortable. They prefer a world without God because it might just mean a more comfortable life for them. And I guess that is a warning to us and to check ourselves. You know, it's not that there's no hope for these guys, that they do believe in Jesus. And of course, that's a good start. But we do need to be careful and that we don't fall into the same trap of caring more about, you know, our reputation here, our livelihoods, our world prospects, and then the glory of the world to come. And what's the problem? The problem seems to be cancel culture, doesn't it? Verse 42, and being put out of the synagogue and being excluded from the inner circle, and fear of being outcast, fear of looking stupid, fear of losing your credibility, and your friends rejecting you, and being isolated from the world. So instead, these people, they prefer to stay quiet, just kind of keep your head down. Much easier in lockdown, isn't it, to do that? Just hunker down and don't really engage with the world around me. Just stay within the four walls of my own home and hope that my unpopular views don't cause me too much trouble. And the approval of others, it is a very tempting thing. And it's a warning. A belief, it can be shallow. I mean, it's not always the right kind. Because the reality is, well, the cross-shaped life, it means death to my comforts. It means losing our lives, Jesus said last passage. Our response to this message, it forces us to be uncomfortable. It exposes the kind of lives we want to live, the kind of glory that we are drawn to. They loved the glory of man more than the glory of God. We started by talking about what stops the world from believing. And I guess, well, and that's what would stop us from believing, if anything, if we're not careful. And they love the glory that comes from man more than the glory that comes from God. But it also means that we don't have to be experts in cultural analysis to understand what puts people off Jesus. And understanding technology and the changes in the cultural landscape, the secularization of the West, engaging with the meaning crisis. And they're all particularly valuable, some of them very valuable things. But it is this message, the message of the cross, that is the dividing line. And when people are confronted with the message of the cross, it will push them in one of two ways. And we shouldn't be surprised when people reject the message. And however strong our apologetics are, however persuasive our big question talks are, and however brilliantly rare the stake is that Matt Ellis makes at our Jesus Skeptics Guide events, and however poetic and moving our sermons are, if we love the wrong kind of glory, we will reject the God who made us, and we'll be left in the dark. And that's what happened in Isaiah's time. It's what happened at Jesus' time. And it happens now. Even as I speak these words, and people are being drawn in one of two directions. A life that is simpler. A life seeking the glory that comes from man. And don't be surprised. Unbelief, it was described way in advance. In their case, it was planned. It was necessary. So don't be thrown, but do be warned. And belief is not always a good thing. And if you're wondering, you know, what hope does this kind of world have? You know, what comfort is there for a world that kind of prefers darkness, that refuses to believe? Well, Jesus opens his mouth in seconds, and he gives some of the most glorious words of hope and light, but we'll look at them next time. And for now, I'm going to leave a moment quiet, and then we'll be led in some prayers.